Ladies and gentlemen, I think it's that when water and tea come, I'm sure one by one, I'm going to have to. So, you know, they take their time, not a lot of people going to come. Thanks for making it, Muslim and your team. For those who don't know, Mr. Muslim is my homeboy.
Oh, I'm getting a dog to
you. So, when we introduce ourselves, I think there is a definition, the head of the teaching is around. And we accepted that because we informed that it was Christmas and so on. Christmas first. I am Jim Kani Kamede, chairing this community of training and traditional situation. For my right, we start around and introduce ourselves.
I'm Jelivan Jonathan, the content advisor for the
Thank you. Asobin Mabib, DDG Corporate Services and CFO. Let's go.
Ian Busson, Office of the Director General.
Dodo Alanich, Director of the Commercial Network. Nicola Chirari, Director of HR. Domenico Brasil, Chief Director of Supply Chain Management.
Good morning, Gunit Africa, Chief Director of Property Management.
Good morning, Sheldon Moulton, Acting Chief Director, Multilateral Branch.
I'm Brittany Varga, PMG.
Good morning, Abdullah Khalid, Supermarket.
Good morning, welcome back. I'm Elza Sandingen from the Eastern Cape.
Good morning, I'm Bev Abraham from Gauteng.
Good morning, Bob Nanin,
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kepesam Tudel, I'm the committee secretary.
One honorable member has just gone outside, others have just joined us. Mr. Moodley, because we know each other, I'm going to be making a few comments on your presentation. That when we went through your presentation, firstly, we are going to time your presentation. It should be more than an hour so that we can engage. Secondly, there are things that have already been presented. You know, either by GECO or DTI. Most of the things that you start with have already been presented. I'm sure if you start with your highlights, some out of your highlights, that would be something more of interest to us. But the rest, I'm sure we've heard it for more than one. So if you structure your presentation so that you cover the time, and also you can tell the PG that next time we'll submit our expectations as a community in our presentation. Because we are the NCOP, we don't want you to do the same presentation that you do in the National Assembly. There are certain matters and key areas of importance that we have an interest in. So as from next year, if we are going to present a strategy, we will write something and say this is our expectation as a NCOP. So, we'll start with the presentation, taking into account that we'll have to engage, waiting if we have some time. Because our experience has been to do a presentation with all the departments, not individually, but little time to engage and and I don't finish. We don't do follow up questions, so it depends now for presentation. So because you are quite used to this, I'm sure you just hit the ground running. Over to you.
So thank you, Chairperson, and other members. just to reiterate the apology by the DG. Therefore, the DG and some of the DDGs are busy with the Head of Mission Review Conference, and therefore they are not present today, but they have passed their apologies. Chairperson, I will go by the input that you've made, and we will try and finish the presentation within an hour, which will incorporate both the presentation on the annual report and a very quick some information from Ms. Lally, the Chief Director, on the ARS. So just a overview on what we're going to do. It's really a situation highlights and then the summary of highlights, as Jefferson has mentioned, which we will concentrate on. And really, that will be then go into a bit of detail on program one, which is the administration program, and program two, which is really international relations and the cooperation, our cooperation work, program three, which is public diplomacy and the state protocol, and, program four, which really is our transfers to international organizations and our membership. On the overview, this is just really a synopsis of our missions, Chairperson and members. As you can see, we have 46 bilateral missions in the on our continent. We have one mission under the Geographical Multilateral, which is Addis Ababa. The Americas and Caribbean, we have 17 missions there. We have 27 missions on the European continent. In the Asia and Middle East region, we have 32 missions, and multilateral takes care of two missions, Geneva and New York. Now, just the situational analysis, honorable members, is that our global environment is currently being characterized by major shifts in the very important areas of global political, socio-economic, cultural dynamics. And as members will recall, there are many new emerging economic powers such as India, China, Brazil. There's new and media social networks that we talk about that we experience daily in our lives. Environmental change, which is a subject of much discussion and is currently the subject of the discussion on the COP18, which is taking place in Doha as well. Members will recall that there's a huge demand for scarce resources, especially those resources that are found in somewhat of a more plentiful nature on the African continent. And members will recall that the nature of the conflict and insecurity across the world is changing considerably. We experienced recently the third wave of democracy being experienced in the Middle East and North Africa regions as well, so there is a quite considerable change in nature of the conflict and insecurity that the world is experiencing. Now, with regard to the new economic new economies like China and Brazil, you would find that they are influencing the global distribution of power, especially the economic power, and of course economic power would also translate to a certain extent to social and political power. And it is challenging, these powers are now challenging the established political and economic order, that is, in terms of the old order, and there are new realities that are being that are replacing the order that is already existing. The South African and African economies are increasingly linked to these new economic powers, and one has to just reflect a bit on the IPSA and the BRICS and the South-South partnerships to understand that in fact the African economies and South Africa, our partnership with these new emerging powers is becoming increasingly more important. Globalization continues to shape the world, a shrinking global environment, and this is notwithstanding the global economic crisis that is currently being experienced. With regard to information platform, social networking, it has a major impact on the governance, especially across the world. Definitely a huge impact on economic activity in terms of the ability to communicate freely and easily within a very short period of time across large areas and across national boundaries as well. The other matter of situational analysis is that natural and man-made disasters are impacting on all aspects of human development and particularly on food security. One has to look at the Middle East at the moment and some parts of our African continent. And recently we had the natural disasters in Japan, but in Pakistan as well. These all impact on the ability of on the security of the world, and especially food security, which is a major concern internationally, and it's also one of the MDGs that we're supposed to be achieving in a few years' time. Conflict between the environment and development is clearly a matters that is being discussed. And I mean, just an example is the nuclear challenges that were experienced in Japan. Now, Japan is, of course, one of the countries that are very keen on the environment, but there has to be a balance in their development and the environment. Clearly, they will have to start producing more energy to see that their economies grow, but producing more energy means an impact on the environment as well. So there's this challenge between the balance on the environment and development, and increasingly there's competition in terms of resources, the requirement for resources. The debt crisis has given a rise to a deep division between the north and the south of Europe, and it endangers the future of the European Monetary Union. There's also rising nationalistic tendencies in Europe itself, and you will recall, honourable members, that there are certain European countries who are now deciding that they should really move out of the European Monetary Area and basically pursue their own interests. In Asia, there are increased tensions over disputed territories, especially in the South China Sea and other parts of Asia, and the U.S. is shifting some of its military assets to Asia, and you would recall that there was a recently there was this concern raised by China with regard to the number of military assets that the U.S. is placing in the Chinese areas. So, and the rest of the slides I will go through very quickly, just to show the number of preferential trade agreements in force from 1950 to 2010, you will see, honourable members, Jefferson, that there's been an increase, a significant increase, in terms of the preferential trade agreements from 1950 to 2010, from almost zero to reaching about 300 as we the performance of emerging markets and developing economies. The red line shows the emerging markets, the emerging and developing economies, and the blue line shows the average performance, and the black line shows the world growth. So honorable members will, from this graph, would be able to recognize that the emerging and developing economies, the growth is very, very rapid. As you can see, from 1990, there's been a significant increase, with a spike in 2009, but picking up quite nicely in 2010. And the projection is that it's on upward trajectory. South-South merchandise in 1995 to 2010, again, you'll find this is increasing upwards. From 1995, it's just about just over 40 to 2009, reaching more than 52, 53. The total trade in goods and services, and this is broken down between developing economies, the transition economies, the developed economies, and other territories. You'll find that with regard to the movement, total trade has moved significantly from 1980 to 2010, both with the developing and the developed economies. But what is very interesting here is the higher increase in the developing economies. The blue line, the blue block that you see, the first column that's going upwards. From 1980 to 2010, you'll find that the developing economies going at an increasing higher rate in terms of our trade in goods and services. Our top 10 trading partners for 2011 starts with China at 13%, and then the rest of the information, as you can see, the BRICS country feature prominently in that, but also the developed countries like Germany, United States, United Kingdom also feature, and this is really a result of our historical partnerships, but also as a result of the growing partnerships with emerging economy powers as well. In terms of manufacturing, this gives you a quick five-star snapshot of manufacturing. You can see that topping the list is basic iron and steel, manufactured exports, followed by motor vehicles at 13%, and then, of course, all of the exports represent 50% of the manufactured exports in 2011. Our countries for exports, China tops the list again at 12.33%, United States at 8.62%. If it goes down, and again, you'll find that Germany, United Kingdom, Netherlands, the traditional EU partners also feature as part of the top 12 in terms of South African exports. Total tourist arrivals to South Africa in 2011, you can see it's just about 8.339 million, and this is from the annual tourism report. You can see it's from 2009. South African trade with Africa, with our continent itself. You can see that in 2009, the exports versus the imports, our exports have always traditionally been more than our imports, higher than our imports, which put the balance of trade really in South Africa's favor. And you find again, with our continent itself, the trade our balance of trade, I mean, is increasing. From 2009, there's been a significant increase in import and exports, as well as an increase in imports. Trade exposure, again, from the DTI, South Africa's trade exposure from 2007 to 2011, again, you'll find for the various different continents, Africa, Asia, the European Union, the United States, you'll find that there's, with the Asian region, there's an upward trajectory, whereas with the United States, it's been more or less stable over the last few years. We spoke about this in terms of the top export markets when I showed you the 12 countries, so this is just a pie representation on that one. But this is really with the EU itself. As you can see, Germany is one of the most important or one of the biggest export markets in the EU, followed by the United Kingdom and the various different other countries we have. Total trade with the Americas, the USA, as usual, is probably our biggest trading partner in the Americas, representing a huge amount of exports and imports. But again, the balance is in South Africa's favor, with exports being more than imports. I think we can go through, we can just skip some of these things. Some of the highlights for the year in 2011-12, we can just take a few minutes on these few slides. It was an extraordinary year for South Africa in terms of our international relations. We had some major diplomatic successes. For example, the facilitation and mediation process in both Zimbabwe and in Madagascar. As you know, Deputy Minister Fransman was also requested to mediate in the Madagascar matter, and the roadmap there. Then we played a leadership role in the post-conflict reconstruction and development process in Sudan. We continued in the year under focus as a non-permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, where we focused on strengthening the relations between the AU and the UNSC, especially the AUPC, the African Union Peace and Security Council, AUPSC, as well as the UNSC. We initiated the SADC EAC Free Trade Agreement, and then President Zuma's champion of the new partnership for African North-South Corridor as part of the Infrastructure Development Championship role that he's playing on the continent. And then we had made six successful preparations for the hosting of the Global African Diaspora Summit that was held on the 21st of May this year. And honorable members will recall that it was outside of the financial year, but it was successfully hosted, and we had a fairly good number of officials and heads of government represented at the summit. We successfully participated in two BRICS summits, the third and fourth BRICS summit, when South Africa was admitted as a BRICS member. And at the moment, our treasury, national treasury, together with the counterparts from the other BRICS countries, are exploring the probability of establishing a new development bank that is being led by the BRICS countries. Last year, honorable chairperson and honorable members, you will recall that we also successfully hosted the COP17 CMD7 in Durban. We did okay in that one. We came out well, and we came out with the results of the Durban platform. The Durban platform basically secured the second commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol. As you know, the Kyoto Protocol comes to an end now in December 2013, and there was no time, it wouldn't have been possible to get the second commitment period now, so we had to do it in Durban last year. And fortunately, the process was able to get the commitment to the second Kyoto Protocol period. There was a unanimous adoption of the Durban platform for enhanced action in terms of climate change and the impacts thereof, and the reduction of the impacts of climate change on the environment, and then resetting the global and environmental agenda. Honorable members, Chairperson, you would recall that we had taken some time to do some lobbying for Dr. Dlamini Zuma as the chairperson of the African Union Commission, and history would say that, would note that she has now been elected as chairperson of the EC. Our experts were also elected to the International Law Commission, the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination, International Residual Mechanism for Criminal Tribunals, and the Council of the International Maritime Organization. Furthermore, we dealt with the mainstreaming of gender issues in the international fora, that is the 56th session of the Commission on the Status of Women. We had 32 structured bilaterals in which we advanced South Africa's domestic priorities as well as the African agenda, that is the agenda of the African continent. We had provided humanitarian assistance to Somalia, Nicaragua, Thailand, Turkey, and Congo. We had provided electoral assistance to DRC and Guinea-Conakry. The improvement of the veterinary laboratories in West Africa, we had supported this through the ARF as well. We conducted this feasibility study on the South African Development Partnership Agency, and the bill was completed. I can just say that as we stand right now, the EPFA has okayed our recommendations with regard to the establishment of SASPA. We are just waiting for the presidency to give us go ahead, and it goes back to the Minister of EPFA for final sign-off, and then we can proceed with the establishment of SASPA. Public diplomacy activities, we had a whole lot of public diplomacy activities, weekly meetings, weekly media briefings, social media, media statements, seminars, and then, of course, in terms of public diplomacy, we played quite an extensive role during the COP17, CNP7, as well as the run-up to the African Diaspora Summit and the lobbying for the chairperson of the AUC. We introduced, in the corporate management of the department, we introduced steps to strengthen our asset register, our asset management, our ICT, and our HR systems. We then brought up a new, developed a new framework for the annual performance plan. You, honorable chairperson members, you will recall that the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation and National Treasury has given us new formats, new requirements for the annual performance plans, which we fully adopted. And I would, I can mention that at this stage we received communication from both National Treasury and the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation to say that our plans comply fully with their requirements. So this unit, the strategic planning M&E unit, is, as well as the new directorate, has been established in the Office of the Director General. We have provided training to 286 officials, protocol training to 1,952 officials from all spheres of government, and 116 African diplomats, mainly from the SADC region, were trained on diplomacy. An economic toolkit was developed for the economic diplomacy, and 96 officials at Air Office were trained, and 27 officials abroad were trained. The Employee Wellness Center provided counseling, and we offer emotional support to 321 employees and their families following the natural disasters and conflicts that we have experienced in the world. The DG established a committee headed by the Chief Director of Finance and the Chief Director of Supply Chain to deal with the audit findings, honorable chairperson and members. Once we did receive an unqualified audit report, there were a number of matters that the Auditor General raised to the department, brought to our attention, which we need to give attention to. And what had happened is we extracted all those findings and we put it onto a schedule, and the Director General employed, established a committee under the leadership of the Chief Director of Finance and the Chief Director of Supply Chain to basically look to the implementation of all the audit findings that were raised and brought to our attention. So basically, chairperson and members, that is really on a high-level summary of what we have reported in our annual report and what some of our achievements during the last financial year. And the rest of the presentation really goes into detail into all of those various different matters. For example, just to give an example, in terms of program on administration, if we go further, in terms of the program,
before we go there, before we go there, I'll run to the two or three numbers first, if we proceed to the third. Then, just take a 2 minutes break so that we have our tea before it is iced tea. Then we'll continue from the program. Members can introduce themselves. Let's keep this item. Now, there are members that need to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Chair.
Good
morning, Chair. My name is Freddy Adams, permanent delegate from the West.
Morning, Chair. My name is Jomanya Ambi from Mpumalanga province.
Morning, Chair. Kenneth Sinclair, Northern Cape, a bit far from me, that's where I'm living.
This region has changed now.
Thank you. They must just let me know. Here's my card, let me know.
I can make a movie for information. It's consular services, and they report by the movie. So I think that's the best.
Work through me, I'll direct you to the specific place.
Because they haven't come back to me yet, so I don't know if they came right. Because it's my sister in Victoria. We have, you know, it's somebody that says, it's my sister in Victoria. But while you know, I think it can be done. We must just do it. And they, this is their problem.
Yeah, and this is really, really, very good counselor. They will, you know, they will either deal with it themselves. If they can't deal with it, they keep in contact with the family until the matter is dealt with. So you can really just give up with it.
I will thank
you. No, it's very, they are really very professional.
The bowl has not got coins, it's got watermelon.
I'll add some time if you can continue. Before you continue, Mr. Minister, I just forgot to thank the department for coming to brief us. Also, thanks very much for our thanks to our country. You can continue with the program.
In problem one, I'm going to basically highlight two matters. The controversy to be dealt with. In terms of the property portfolio, members will recall that there was some discussion with regard to our acquiring chancery and official residence abroad, because we have a fairly high rental bill for the provision of accommodation abroad. So we developed a acquisition strategy which we take to national treasury. Of course, it went through the DG and our minister, through to national treasury. National treasury agreed with the strategy, but what they did not agree with was to convert our rentals into bonds, because no department has been on the terms of the PFM has the ability to borrow money or take loans. It's only with the Minister of Finance. But what they did indicate was that we go into a very organized, systematic acquisition strategy which will support. So as we stand right now, feasibility assessment is being conducted, and we have a strategy for the acquisition of property which Treasury will assist us with, where we actually start buying, or three ways: either we buy property where it is possible, where we own land, we will try and construct chanceries and official residences. If we can't do it with a private PPP agreement, a public-private partnership agreement, then we will do it in the traditional manner, with regard to constructing official residences and chanceries. In those countries where we could go the route of a PPP, advantageously, of course, with the involvement of the Treasury PPP unit and all the various different structures, public works and so forth, then we will go that way as well. So essentially, there is a strategy in place, and the strategy is currently being worked out. So then, with regard to the financial management part of it, I just wanted to highlight the fact that we have, I don't see it there, but although we've received the unqualified offer, I just want to highlight the fact that we have an implementation plan. We have an action plan that will deal with all the audit matters that was raised. In fact, to such an extent that I think in the 2012-13 financial year, there is every probability that we should not receive any matters of serious concern from the audit agenda. Then we go to human resources. Chairperson, honorable members, on the human resources slides, we find that in the approved establishment of the department, we had 2,784, so 2,392 filled, which left us with a vacancy rate of 14.1%. Now, during the year under review, 323 of those posts were filled, 110 being external candidates and 121 being internal candidates. Now, of course, the challenge is that although you filled 323 posts, if 121 comes internally, it essentially means that those 121 posts would have left gaps below them. By filling the higher post, it would have left those 121 gaps below them. So whilst we say 324 posts were filled, it would have the impact when we filled from within the department. Appointments on contact, there were 92. Then we did a full review of the unfunded posts that were existing in the establishment. And in line with the DPSA directive, these posts were then abolished because they were in on the establishment, but there was no funding for them, and they were there for a long period of time, so it was the DPSA directive was to be abolished. We have employment equity status, so I just want to flag that we are still working towards 50% gender equity, gender parity in the department, and you can see senior SMS members are still currently at 36%, and people with disabilities are still at 1.5%. We're working towards the 50% and 2% as is required in terms of the parliament directives. I will go past the occupational performance agreement. And with regard to GTR, the chairperson colleagues, I basically mentioned the number of trainings that are going to be provided. This chart gives us the statistics of the number of trainings that are going to be provided for various people
But what is very important is that the next slide is that the accreditation of the courses that we present in the department. We have a Master of Diplomacy program at the University of Master of Diplomacy program in at the University of Pretoria, and an executive development program which actually leads to a Master's in Public Administration for our senior managers. And then just to say that with regard to our policy research and analysis unit, they normally support the principals and our senior managers for academic engagements. A number of discussion forums were held, and also they had quite a few discussions on top 17 CMP categories that are not to be some of the answer we conference as well. With regard to the program two, Chairperson and members, on the actual agenda, I will very quickly, because back to Lali here, we'll talk more just now, a few minutes time on the actual liaison fund. But just to say that we served as a member of the Security Council, and we chaired the AEPSC in May 2011. Now, some of the items that we have dealt with was the number of the Security Council, but really the security sector is reform. With regard to the Security Council of the United Nations, the protection of civilians, especially on the continent, and I mentioned earlier the cooperation between the United Nations and the African Union, especially the Security Council, with regard to peace support operations. This item has since culminated in the adoption of United Resolution 2017 of 2012, formalizing the cooperation between the AUPSC and the United Nations. We chaired the African Union Ministerial Committee on Post-Conflict Reconstruction in Sudan, I mentioned that earlier, and there was a whole lot of other work that we had done on the continent, especially with the presence dealing with the MENA countries and the involvement in Zimbabwe and Madagascar. Then, in terms of, as I said, with regard to the African Renaissance Fund, I will leave that to Dr. Lali in a few minutes. There's a whole lot of benefits that we dealt with in the African Renaissance Fund. We spoke about Ethiopia and APRM, Israel ARS. I spoke about Madagascar and the organ, the maritime. Then with regard to central issues, Chairperson and members, we participated in the 21st Ordinary SADC Summit in August 2011. The RISDP, South Africa's desk assessment of the RISDP was concluded, and full implementation of the SADC humanitarian assistance to Somalia, which Dr. Lali will pick on a little later, we also finalized that. South relations. I think here, what is important is the BRICS membership and the BRICS summit. Now, earlier I mentioned that our president attended the third BRICS summit in Sanya in Hainan Island, PRC in China. And then we also attended the fourth BRICS summit in New Delhi, where the Delhi Action Plan was developed. And that's one of the most important outcomes of the Delhi Action Plan was the establishment of the feasibility study for the establishment of a new development bank, a new BRICS-led development bank. So that's on South relations. And then just to go further, we also the ISTA summit. Sorry, Chairperson and colleagues, I'm sorry, these are my colleagues, members. Just to note that the first BRICS summit will be held in South Africa in March 2013. From the 25th to the 27th of March 2013, the President has approved that the first BRICS summit, because we are the first member to join the BRICS group, we will be required to host the BRICS first BRICS summit. So that will be also from 25th to 27th March in Delhi. And also, with regard to South relationships, I spoke about the ISTA summit, which was hosted on the 18th of October in Swane, where the outcomes were the Swane Declaration, the MOU on mutual cooperation among the Rio Branco Institute of the Ministry of External Relations of the Federal Republic of Brazil, and the Foreign Service Institute of External Affairs of India, and DTR, the Diplomatic Research and Training Development Care branch of our department. There was a MOU that was signed in terms of coordination among the various departments. Now, with global system of governance, Chairperson and members will recall that we participated in the UNX NSC and also our yearly participation in UNGA as well. With regards to our non-permanent membership to the United Nations Security Council, what we have been able to achieve was to raise South Africa's profile as a potential permanent member. Part of the security sector reform requirements is that the permanent membership of the United Nations Security Council be broadened. The five existing members are there and they have power of veto and so forth. So really without the involvement of the other members is, to a certain extent, does not have the same weight as the five founding members. So the reform is really to open that process up a bit more to getting members from the African continent, our continent, as well as the Asia and the Middle East. So we focus on promoting the African agenda, and you would recall earlier I mentioned the cooperation between the AU Peace and Security Council as well as the United Nations Security Council, the importance of developing effective partnerships between the United Nations and our regional and sub-regional organizations, especially with regard to maintaining international peace and security. And then we had presided over the United Nations Security Council in January 2012 and adopted the resolution in 2013. With regard to contributing with the global system of governance, we became the chair of the African Commission on Nuclear Energy, AFCON, for a period of 3 years. Now we have elected to host the AFCON in South Africa, and I'm glad to inform members and chairpersons that indeed the Treasury has granted the funding for us to be able to host the AFCON in South Africa. We have got the hosting and the accommodating of AFCON here. So we've got that, and we are in process to actually finalize that in some financial year. So I will skip over some of the slides because we've actually dealt with the Kyoto Protocol and the COP17, so we're going to talk further on that. And on the Africa Outreach Program, the first assessment report was presented since the partnership in 2000, and then the GA's assessment report on food security and health were also presented, and we addressed issues of African development within the context of regional integrated integration, different regions on the continent and economic growth, and we also deliberated on security-related issues. I mean, we spoke quite extensively on food security, and the food, on the outcome of the 6th G20 summit, price volatility and agricultural challenges which lead to food security, but there is an action plan that has been developed to address those challenges. Then the support for the multilateral development banks to build human resources. Members and chairpersons will recall that the BRICS countries also have pledged to recapitalize the IMF and the World Bank to the extent of about $50 billion. Our country as well has pledged support to the extent of $2 billion as callable capital in order to support the development of the with regard to agreements, a total of 106 bilateral and multilateral agreements were signed or entered into force for South Africa during the period of the financial year. 93 were bilateral and 13 were multilateral agreements. I will just move a lot of these things, Chairperson and honorable members would have been presented to the committee by the various different briefing sessions. I won't dwell too much on them, considering that we have about 10 minutes more for the hour. I'll just keep on certain slides. Let's go to slide number 61. Yeah. So just here on this one, Chairperson, I just would like to pick up the fact that our Deputy Minister Ibrahim hosted the first member for the Sahrawi Arabic Democratic Republic in April 2011, and members will recall that our position is that the SADR should be a self-governing country, a sovereign territory. Then Minister Kwana Mashabana also hosted the Somali Minister of Foreign Affairs in March 2012, and we also received a special envoy from Libya in January 2012, and a special envoy from Libya had requested South Africa's assistance in the PCRD in the post-conflict reconstruction of Libya, which we are considering at the moment. The rest of it in terms of the agreements, we gave the overall summary. This is just the details of the agreements that we have entered into. Then we can go to public diplomacy page on slide number 72. On public diplomacy, Chairperson and members, there's always been the question of whether our public diplomacy unit was doing enough. I am happy to say that the public diplomacy has been scaled up quite
considerably in the past year. The branch has provided a lot of support to the political heads, ministers, president, deputy presidents, deputy ministers. 21 events were organized departmentally as part of communicating the pillars of the country's foreign policy. As I mentioned earlier, the public diplomacy unit was involved extensively during the COP17 CNP7. Members would probably have recalled that even on SAA, there was an advert that was playing all during the course of the COP17 closure for the run-up to the conference. The president also had a television program dealing with the climate change matters, and then many billboards, dressings at the airports, newspaper articles. There was even an article on the Sorbonne magazine with regard to the effects of climate change and the COP17 CNP7 conference that was held in Durban in November and December 2011. So the Public Diplomacy Unit has signed a MOU in South Africa to consolidate partnership domestically and internationally, and they're collaborating with Grand South Africa on various different marketing initiatives, which included the COP17, and now it's now also going forward with regard to the BRICS summit for March next year. I mentioned the ETV Live Trust, and these are some of the programs of public diplomacy that have also undertaken. Ministries of Public Participation Outreach Programs, there were 9 that was undertaken in the financial year. Media Briefing 61 we hosted, we spoke about the rest of them, and then the new media platform that we explored as well. Our department is also utilizing Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and publications to really explain to publicize our conferences. Then with the state protocol, chairperson and colleagues, I'm sorry, members, you would note that the representation in South Africa has grown quite significantly from 68 foreign representatives in 1994 to 311. And the 311 in 2011 made up of 129 diplomatic missions, 19 non-resident representatives, 50 consular posts, 82 honorary consular posts, and 7 international organizations, and 1 liaison office, that is the Taipei liaison office, which brings us to 311 offices representing foreign and international organizations. So the branch has coordinated 154 incoming and 131 outgoing state official and working visits for the president and deputy president, 159 outgoing visits for provincial and local governments, 1 consultative forum workshop, 103 official ceremonial events that we normally host, such as the opening of parliament speech and the diplomatic dinner by the minister and so forth, 10 conferences, which include the COP17, the SAEU summit, the IFTA summit that we spoke about earlier, and the Troika meetings and so forth. So 10 conferences were managed by the branch during the year and the region. Let's go back one. Just to say that with regard to the guest houses, members and chairperson, the 2 state guest houses have been renamed. The presidential guest house in Pretoria is now called the Sefako and Makwato Presidential Guest House, whilst the diplomatic guest house in Waterproof will be renamed the Johnny Makatini Guest House. Regrettably, we were not able to launch those names just yet because of discussions that are taking place with the family, but it is anticipated that in February next year, we will officially name these guest houses. The King Shaka State Protocol Lounge was inaugurated in June 2011. You will recall that we had brought the lounge into operation in 2010 for the World Cup, June 2010 for the World Cup, but the official inauguration took place in June 2011. And just to say that 42,000 dignitaries were facilitated through these lounges. These are some of the statistics for the state protocol in terms of the work that they do, and clearly the statistics in terms of the presence and of credentials and so forth that normally the protocol needs. Program 4, with regard to international transfers, chairperson and members will recall that our department is responsible for the payments to or the transfers to international organizations. During the year under review, 427 million rands was transferred to international organizations, and this is the breakdown of the transfers. A chunk of it goes to the United Nations and its agencies, as well as the African Union and its agencies. So these are the details of the transfers to international organizations.
Chairperson, with your permission, I would like to stop there. And with your permission, I would like to hand over to Ambassador Lally, who will take us through very quickly on here.
Thank you very, very much, the Chairperson of the Committee on Trade and International Relations and Honorable Members of the NCOP. I will take you through what the African American Fund has done in the year under review. I will also, if you will indulge me, touch on some of the highlights of what we have done as well in the period post the end of March 2012. Because much as we are here to give a historical look based on the annual report, because of the period that's covered, but a lot of the important work that is done is current rather than historical. But if it's information you don't need, please let me know. Just a brief background about where the African Investment Fund comes from. It was established in 2001 through an Act of Parliament and replaced a previous one on economic cooperation, which dates back to 1968. And its purpose is to enhance cooperation between the Republic and other countries, in particular countries of Africa, to promote democracy and good governance, to prevent and resolve conflicts, to encourage socio-economic development and integration, and to provide humanitarian assistance and human resources development. And if we talk about the utilization of the fund, our minister, in consultation with the Minister of Finance, has established an advisory committee which consists of the Director General of DIRCO as the chair, together with officials drawn from the three departments, the bulk of which come from DIRCO, but we have two standing members from the Department of Finance. And this committee recommends to the ministers on which projects should be approved and funds disbursed to. And this fund is disbursed only upon approval by the two ministers. And this approval is done through a very sometimes lengthy and formal process of concurrent letters. And loans or other financial assistance that is granted is also done so in accordance with agreements and service level agreements between the relevant parties. The Director General of DIRCO is the accounting officer for the fund. And he has established the Secretariat, which sits at Africa Multilateral, which assists with the activation of this project and the disbursement of this fund. In the year under review, the income that the fund received was over 520 million. 450 million was a transfer payment and subsidies for the fund, which were appropriated by Parliament. 77 million was interest that had been received from investments on the amount, which are deposited with the Corporation for Public Deposits, the Reserve Bank, and the expenditure that the fund incurred in the annual review was over 280 million. We can give a detailed breakdown of that spend. And this has gone to various projects, and 9 million is a provision of impairment of trade receivables. Something that I'm sure Mr. Mutu will talk more about because he's a financial guru. And the surplus for the year was 247 million. And just a highlight of the projects that were considered and approved for the financial year under review. One was for technical assistance to the mandate of the United Nations Independent Expert on Human Rights in Extreme Poverty of the United Nations Human Rights Commission, which resulted in rest of the Western Cape to the tune of 1.2 million. The contribution that was mentioned in Mr. Moody's presentation to the improvement of veterinary lab capabilities in sub-Saharan countries via the IAEA to the tune of 15 million rand. We have also allocated funds to our diplomatic training academy. We have allocated 30 million rand for them to conduct training not only for South African diplomats, but for diplomats born from African countries. And this is one of our flagship programs. There was an economic aid package to Cuba that was approved of 100 million rand. That has not yet been dispersed, I must point out, as we are still concluding MOUs and signing service level agreements. And we've also allocated money towards participation.
participation in SADC election observer mission, and in the end of review we set aside $5 million, and this was used to cover election observer missions to the Seychelles, to the DRC, to Lesotho, and one that falls outside of the reporting period but just as important is Angola. And we also provided humanitarian assistance at Somalia. And we also assisted the DRC in its election campaign to the tune of that much. And a lot of that went to the South African National Defence Force for assistance with the transportation of ballot boxes within the DRC. Over and above what we've already mentioned, we have got recommended projects amounting to $141 million, which are still awaiting approval and letters of concurrence from the Minister of Finance. And in compliance with the accrual accounting system, these projects have not been recognized as a spend checking of funds for the financial year, as the money has not yet been disbursed. And these will be moved on to monies expended once the disbursement has happened. The way forward, we are in the process of developing an operational policy and guidelines for the fund. But this, I must say, we are doing fully cognizant of the fact that the African Renaissance Fund will be replaced by SADFA, the South African Development Partnership Agency, which Mr. Mudi has already referred to. So all the projects and funds that currently sit in the app will be migrated to SADFA as soon as it's operational. And the challenge that we have noted in this year, particularly in response to humanitarian crises in the Sahel region as a result of extreme drought, which has led to severe food security, which we've assisted with, and also some of the problems which have played themselves out, most notably in Mali, as a result of that area being awash with all the arms that came from Libya. This is our ability to respond very quickly to humanitarian crisis is something that we really need to pay attention to. Recently, the committee might be aware that the Prime Minister of Lesotho came to see our President last month to come and request assistance because Lesotho is also in the throes of a severe drought and is suffering extreme food security. And we are trying very hard to respond to that timely. But the manner in which our systems are structured does not allow us to be fleet-footed enough to respond to crises, especially those that affect life and death, as in the case of the city. And other issues are delays in the process of disbursement, which has to do with the concurrent letters, but we are convinced that these will be addressed and understood. And another one is to include an element of monitoring and evaluation in the projects that we do fund, because especially for those, the majority of which are outside the country, carried out by people in those countries, we do need to find a structured mechanism for ensuring that the monies are used for the purposes they were requested and that they contribute to what was intended by the South African government. Thank you very much.
Thanks for that. Just allow the presentation to continue because we have previously been without documentation. We don't have documentation for the but we have been briefed earlier on about the AR. So just to refresh some of the things. Honourable members, time now for clarity and questions, more explanation. Honourable Nyambi,
thanks, Chair. I'm
even though you tried to deal with it, but you were not detained. The issue of the department dealing with the select committee is not only about compliance. So in future, Chairperson, let's raise it very loud and clear that we are not going to accept this apology, that we are not going to have either a postcard head or the DG, because it's not about the compliance that they have to come and present and will have apologies that they are not here. There are some of the serious questions that we have to direct to them in dealing with this report. It's an issue that we have to address at a particular stage, Chairperson. But beyond that, in welcoming the report, there is slight improvement compared to what happened in the previous financial year. But I'd be like Honorable Mkuli to indicate that you don't praise a fish for swimming, because if it's not swimming, it's going to die. The issue of vacancy rate is not something that we can be proud of. The president from the early in his State of the Nation address was very clear about this issue. And it was raised then, and it's still a challenge. If you can comment about that one so that we can understand what you're going through, why it's not still high. It's linked to the issue of disability. If I remember very well, in our last engagement, we even, as a select committee, said we are available to link you with the relevant bodies that have people living with disabilities that can assist. Because we can't year in, year out, come and talk about one and the same body. So there must be. It's not a question of whether we have a choice. It's a matter of months that we have to address this issue once and for all. Even the issue of your management not reflecting what was said by the president. It's an issue that worth about the 30 days payment. I don't want to talk about what was said yesterday by the Minister of Finance, but it's an issue that we are consistent about it. That if you want to see whether you talk of emerging entrepreneurs, but if we're not paying them as per the maximum date, then we are setting them for failure. Chairperson, we are aware that we have national departments and provincial and municipalities that are engaged in their own international relation programs. The annual report is not reflecting on this. And as you are the custodian of South African foreign policy in terms of coordinating that aspect, do we have the capacity to do that? The other issue is the steps that are, what steps are being taken in the current financial year to address the findings by the AG in the financial year that we are dealing with. If you can clarify us so that you can have a sense whether we are taking some 100 steps forward, how many backwards? This is not 100 forward, 500 backwards. What has been the impact of the economic toolkit that was developed for economic diplomats? I must emphasize on that one that we were so fortunate when the department made a presentation, as when we were doing the introduction, we were very clear that we were coming from different provinces. And we were so we even praised what is being done by the department, because the toolkit is very clear about the different provinces, the very same interests we are representing as members of parliament. And Chairperson, maybe I'm the only one who was left out. If I remember very well, in that presentation, there was an undertaking that once you are back in your training that was to be held in Germany, if I remember very well, you are going to provide each and every member of this select committee the toolkit so that we can be able to have more knowledge about what you are doing, because in the absence of knowledge, perception becomes a reality. The other issue, Chairperson, is about steps that are being taken to supervise and ensure compliance of the supply chain management in missions. Can they be that one? The steps be clarified to us. The last one, if you may allow me, Chairperson. The AG found that there was lack of understanding of National Treasury framework for managing framework performance. Why was that? And how would this be addressed? I think I can stop here for now, Chair. Maybe I can come back at a later stage. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I'd like to know if there's any policy that I've missed on the equity that relates to being an African. Because I haven't read it, if you can give me that, I can follow up, because I've seen some of the reports that has changed from black to African. And then also the bilateral agreements. During this year we had a workshop on bilateral. And I want to know, what is the purpose of signing all these agreements? How is it followed up? And, you know, what do we do with it? Because we end up signing and nothing happens. And then on which page can I find the AG's report? And, please, thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I always enjoy foreign relations. I think it's very exciting with the face of South Africa out there. When you look at the face of South Africa out there, it's almost a marketing tool for our country and for our economy. Now, the first big job that we did was the one called Dr. Dlamini Zuma. And we were all very excited, but what were the costs involved in the entire exercise? Because it was over quite a long period. And a lot of it came in this financial year, if I'm not mistaken. But surely there was a little bit of a budget for it too. And then on slide 54, the bilateral and multilateral agreements. The other day I saw there was a report at ATC that had a couple of energy agreements or MOUs, and I asked for them and I got them. What worries me is that these energy agreements are just signed, and I don't understand why they are just signed, because why would we sign a thing with Egypt? What would be the purpose behind it? I've marked here slide 77. It goes about the overseas trip. And the interesting one is the second one. Now, I've got this thing about municipalities just going overseas. But recently we've had a bit of a question about provinces going over and what they're doing overseas and so on. Is there a list available for us, and also of local government going over, because very often it is just a jaunt and not a real trip. And you may listen to this with your tongue in the cheek, saying that it's fine for us for, because we also go overseas and overseas trips, but as long as these gains for the provinces, and I want to know what gains the provinces are bringing home because of, in terms of finances. And I'm specifically interested in the Eastern Cape and then in the oil business, what is coming home. Monitoring in the evaluation report, is this in this green document of yours? The book? Is it in the book? I would like to see a copy of that if it's at all possible. And then the ambassador referred to the delays because of structuring of the fund transfer processes. What is wrong and how can it be fixed? And then, you know, my honourable colleague here referred to the DG that's not here. But it's not only the DG that's guilty. The DA does a scorecard every year about which ministers perform and which ministers don't perform. And we don't always see our minister with us. She's not always attending, and maybe we must just ask that she does come and come and meet with us. We might be the NCOP, but we're still a House of Parliament. Interesting, the social media program that you had. So you're sending the messages out. Is there feedback on that? And what was the feedback? And where are we going with it? And what are we doing with it to improve our communication with the market out there? And I think that for the time being is enough. Thank you, Chairperson. Oh, and excuse me, Chairperson, there's one more. AFCON, the Implied 50, the three-year thing. If I could have more information on that, please. Thank you.
The book, I talk about the author, CIA Incorporated.
how actually intelligent people, they leave something behind so that they are able to go back there in order to gather information. And now when you're purchasing this property, how safe is it? And if you do cause that, because according to that book, they're planting something or they're planting their devices when they build there, because that they are going to contract us to which one they build, they're putting their devices so that you'll see it, but even after 5 years, after 10 years, they are able to activate it. Now, I'm thinking about those like how vulnerable our foreign property where our machines are connecting to such intelligent activities, and how do you have the capacity to depart them. Mm-hmm. And lastly, Chairperson, if I'm not mistaken, I think we borrowed, or rather we intended to give Swaziland 200 million rand, of which the conditions are attached to it. And if I read the media right, Swaziland has taken assets because of those conditions. I just want to find out how far is the situation, and what is South Africa's view as far as governance is concerned. I don't know if there might be 45 questions, but I think in the absence of
that's fine. A couple of questions and comments on your public diplomacy program. It's just dedicated to an effect to change. Which is supposed to be a copy. Would you have so insufficient for public engagement? If you want to really engage. The issue of roadshows shows that the three have been held, and they also seem to be high level. Are we getting the target that we need? The population of South Africa being reached adequately. And there's the issue of priorities, national priorities. In most cases in your mission, you'll find DECO and DJI and of late in a few or two suburban tourism that are squatting. DECO would have deal with some priorities. DTI is going back, whereas it's one country. Take the issue of ITED, you take the issue that you presented. You see DECO concentrating on Africa, opening more machines in Africa. You see DTI going more, especially in Asia. I don't know whether someone is going to follow somebody or is going to go to bed because we are one country. Now, as custodians of South African foreign policy, does the department have the capacity to do that? And there's the issue that has been raised about provinces and local governments. Also the second or third question on that. Because we are one country. How does the department coordinate or supplement provincial or local international relations so that our country fits in one box? I think I said this example in one presentation, that one mayor visited another country,
following with the president is of the same country. And in welcoming the president, that country said, hey, we are pleased to have you now, Mr. President, your mayor was here last week. The president was not aware, so it's one country just floating through an area, no one knows what is happening. So this is the coordination. How would you How does the public participate in influencing foreign policy? According to your own strategy, not utilizing us as politicians, showing your threat plan and saying what will make the public so that they know they can also influence. On the issue of IARF, I'm not sure whether we'll see in the, right now in the ITU or the MOCHA, because I don't know when, you know. But we seem not to be deriving any specific benefits, because we don't think we have at least. But other countries, like the USA, the USA, if they believe there should be some economic benefits. You establish a relationship with the country so that at a later stage we've got bilateral, we change and we do that. But for us, it's just a deal. The issue raised by the AG about employment outside DECO, how far are you? And I wish I could work at DECO and still keep my job on. One issue which we have a problem with, even as a community, I don't know, but the monitoring of your foreign mission. I think once people are processed, even we as a community, we cannot just go on a trip just to monitor foreign mission. And how do you monitor the media? You know, they go there, they attend it, and so on. We only monitor them if we have got a study tour, then we go to the mission, then we find out what's happening. But I think all of us need to have a structure just to monitor our foreign mission. Otherwise, the last part one in our is the issue that is raised by the NG also, that there's absence of security and disaster recovery measures in your IT. So now you've got a nice new headquarters there in Pretoria, which are just standing alone there as you pass the road. So if something were to happen, something natural, so you lose everything. What plan do you have now? You have some records and so on. Last but one issue is the issue which you did not touch on, but I must ask. It's an issue about Taiwan. Is the public sufficiently informed of the relations with that country? You know, Taiwan decides at the same time you go to all the electrical shops which come from Taiwan. Whereas there's no formal relationship with that country. But which means they find a way of doing it. I just want your comment, eh? And the last one, which is a nice, hot, and sweet potato, is the issue of the Dalai Lama. I just want your comments on that. So that, you know, we need to push in South Africa. They need to know what is happening. They will ask themselves questions, but why, you know, this person is an issue about it. I think he must be having some communicate, he must be communicating with the country about this issue. You must be communicating with South Africa so that we are all on par, we know what is happening. Now everything is quiet, and one person will just invite the Dalai Lama and then, hey, there will be some noise. I just want to comment there. Thanks, Mr. Mukhi. Oh, sorry. Oh, Honorable Sinclair. By the way, Honorable Sinclair,
shook a hand with the Dalai Lama in India.
I was just going to say that I was actually astounded to see how eager some of the ANC comrades was to meet the Dalai Lama in India. Chair, I've got a number of issues to raise. Let me start to say that it's difficult to deal with the policy issues if the political lead is not here. But I would have requested the minister maybe to send the deputy minister, Frans, more overseas. Then there might be these problems in the Western Cape. Understanding the context of a multipolar world, it's interesting to look at the approach that the party has got in terms of many of the crucial issues that's facing the continent and the world at large. The one issue that I must reach is the issue about regionalism in your approach, and specifically regarding SADC. Now, we serve on many committees, and one of the issues that it seems to be really problematic in the SADC context is the one about SADC and the customs union that is not really coming off the ground. Now, I know this is a sort of cross-cutting issue, but what is the party doing trying to say that specific one? Broader SADC context. Then, Chair, the other issue is the one about BRICS. There's a lot of hype about BRICS. Unfortunately, I must still see the benefits for South Africa, not the benefits for China, not the benefits for India, so on. And I suppose you would be well aware of the dispute between Brazil and South Africa at the moment about the chicken and so on, and there was a report to the WTO about that and trying to facilitate and mediate that challenge. But the long and short is that strategically I think South Africa is very well suited to deal with that issue, but specifically regarding the China-South African relationship, what is the benefit there? If you look at the figures that you presented here, it seems continuously that China is taking our raw materials and our people have not benefited. And that is some of the serious challenges that we must deal with. Now, coming then to the broader picture, specifically regarding America, I didn't pick anything up about the very important agreement, the one about AGOA. What is the position on that one? Because I still maintain that, you know, there must be a balance between the so-called big countries in the world. Yeah, Chair, then the issue was raised about Dalai Lama and also about Taiwan. But then in your report on page 134 at the back, there is a specific reference to a number of consultants that's been used. Now, if you look at the breakdown there, you would see that some of these are really big amounts, like 20 million, 21 million for four consultants in Abuja. Now, it's design work, it's architects and quantity surveyors and engineers and so on. Similarly, there's one in Malawi, 12 million and so on and so forth. But in essence, why is it necessary to use such expensive consultants? Thank you, Chair.
I just forgot the issue of training. But, you know, training that you mentioned, whether for economic diplomacy, involves problems with the local team. And on the issues that you have been doing this year, I think it's a movement. People did that, didn't mention doing something during the ANC continuum, just give that report during the night of the week. But you know, we'd like to know how you do the contribution. So
so that we don't get questions in the house about the interview.
No, thank you very much, Chairperson, and members, thanks very much for those questions. We will attempt to answer as many as possible, and of course those Chairperson that we are unable to answer will come back to the answers to you. The first thing I would like to say is we take note of the sentiments by the committee with regard to the Minister and the Deputy Ministers. The person is there from the DG office. We will, as soon as I get back to the office tomorrow, we will prepare a memo. The Minister and the Deputy Minister to indicate that the committee would like the political principles to attend some of these briefings and also to have a session with the committee as well. So we take note of that, and as well as the DG, we will communicate with the committee on that. I mean, with the Minister and the Deputy Minister on that. Members, with regard to the economic diplomacy toolkit, and the matter of information, I would once again like to, on behalf of the department, invite the members to come to our building in Victoria, in Johannesburg. We have the toolkit, and we were hoping that the October visit would have taken place, so we would have given the toolkits to the members as well. Seeing that it was not able to take place, I would like to be guided. Shall we send the toolkit in any event? Or would we rather try and arrange another visit, because we'd really like to have you at our visit so that we can communicate further. So the toolkits are available. It's quite a big box with books in it, so it's available. It's just a matter of whether we should now send it down to Peter to distribute it to the committee, or would you rather come to our department and have it. We'd like to invite you.
Don't worry. Come in our progress. Come in there for a number of days and prepare. So we'll take a look at that to the
Mr. Doherty, on the questions, I will leave all the questions on the Africa and the African continent to Ambassador Lali. The questions that were, we'll group the questions so that we answer them in groups. The questions on coordination, provincial and local government coordination, Ambassador Lali will be part of the answer, and if there's any input that I will make that as well. The HR questions, clearly, Ms. Tribal Shikari, HR will deal with that. The questions on the Middle East, specifically the question on the Dalai Lama, I will leave to Ian. Okay? The questions on properties, Chief Director of Properties Management is here. The question on supply chain management and the process of emissions, we have the Chief Director of Supply Chain who will deal with it. Then I'm going to ask Dr. Moulton to deal with the United Nations Security Council and the African Union Peace and Security Council and the interlink between the two, as well as the achievements that Mr. Nguni, the Excellency Member Nguni has spoken about with regard to the African Ambassador. Yes, has spoken about, and in terms, so we'll deal with that, and also on the AFCON, I will just ask him to deal with the AFCON as well. Now, just a few things that I will deal with before I hand over. Chairperson, I take note again of the comments and the sentiments with regard to public diplomacy. I would like to reassure the committee that our focus on public diplomacy has increased threefold since 2009. Whereas we started with a budget of approximately 20 million rand in public diplomacy around 2009, the budget has now increased to about 47 million rand, just on public diplomacy and outreach programs. With regard to the outreach programs, there were 9 of them that took place in the 2011-12 financial year, and there's another 10 that took place in the 2012-13 financial year. The programs work such where the minister or the deputy minister actually goes down to the community level. For instance, I recall that in Western Cape itself, I was with the minister when that outreach program took place. We went to the University of Western Cape, where the minister engaged with the students, with the university students. Then in the north, in Limpopo, northwest, where the minister had a session with the community itself. She had a huge session in the hall. There was an engagement with the university. Then there was an engagement with the community members as well. So the state protocol and public diplomacy goes to some considerable, steps to get the involvement of the community and explain foreign policy and so forth. But what we will do is we will take this forward to public diplomacy, just for us to get more information and to advertise it a bit more extensively, more clearly. So indeed, those outreach programs are there. But if the committee thinks that we should do a little more work on that, then of course we will take that further as far as that is concerned. Now, with regard to the voting on Libya, I think Ambassador Lally can stop me from saying anything wrong. But our minister has explained a few times with regard to the fact that when we voted for Libya, for the involvement in Libya, it wasn't for the purpose of killing regime change and innocent lives being lost. It was to deal with the challenges that was placed in, that was being faced in Libya itself. In fact, our president was very clear on that. He actually went to, together with the African Union, the high-level committee panel, high-level panel of experts, to deal with that particular matter. So it wasn't for regime change. It wasn't to innocent civilians, and there was clearly no intention for the outcomes that took place in Libya itself. How did we regain our credibility? I would like to say that our credibility was never in question, because we voted in the manner that we were supposed to vote in that. In fact, in other situations, when it came to Syria and the various different other challenges that arose in the MENA countries, the same approach was taken in the challenges that we had faced in terms of the fact that our stance is very clear that in terms of governance, democracy, the people must decide. The people will determine what direction that the country takes. So our voting has always been to support good governance in all of these countries. But you would recall that we specifically was very clear about the way we voted in terms of other matters thereafter, in terms of regime change. So, but I think Dr. Moulton and Ambassador Lally would give us more information with regard to that one. The policy on equity on African versus black, Ms. Rather will talk about that very quickly. With regard to the AGE's department, it's on page 20 to 22 of part 3 of the annual report. And that's where you would find the reference to the performance information. There was a question on the AGE's report and performance information in what was raised. You would find it in the AGE's report. And it really, the sum total of the AGE's report is that our compliance with the SMART principle, achievable, realistic, was a bit problematic, and that's why I think Ian Basson, who is now leading the monitoring and evaluation unit and the strategic planning unit in the AGE's office, will tell us more about how we are going forward with regard to that. Now, with regard to the Swaziland 200 million rand conditions, Chairperson, I think this is a matter that National Treasury is the lead department on, because I do recall that the Minister of Finance was engaging with the Swaziland authorities on the 200 million rand loan that they wanted. But I would ask Ambassador Lally if she has any further information. With regard to the DTI DECO, the Chairperson mentioned that there may be different approaches and different areas of focus, different emphasis by between DTS and DTI. I would like Ian just to talk about how we cooperate or we coordinate the work in the mission. If there's DECO, DTI, tourism is not normally resident in the mission, but where they are resident, and if there's other departments like agriculture and so forth, how the work is coordinated in terms of the annual performance plan, so that the focus areas are not contradictory and conflicting. We'll talk about that. With regard to the monitoring of missions, now I only have Ambassador Lally who is running the mission. I'll ask Ian and Ambassador Lally just to talk. But I just to say how we use the business plan, the annual performance plan, the business units' heads, the monthly feedback from the missions through to the department, the quarterly reporting process, and the annual reporting process as far as the monitoring of missions are concerned. And we can. Chairperson is engaged as to how you would like us to filter or factor that information from missions through to the college, through to the committee as well. Do we have capacity as custodians of foreign policy? I would also ask
Dr. Ravi and Ian to comment on that one. How does the public participate in implementing foreign policy? Chairperson, you will recall that we have the diplomatic research and training division in our department. Now, that division, the Diplomatic Academy under the leadership of DDG Modulo, is responsible for holding a number of forums, events, that include, that invites members of the public, academics, various different professionals to come in and discuss and deliberate on foreign policy. We normally get outcomes document for that. I could get you the full details on when this occurred and so forth. We get the outcomes document, which we then present to the DG and the minister. To add to that, there will be the Philippine Council on International Relations, that one. That, as we have presented previously, it has gone through the cabinet. Cabinet has approved the establishment of SACWA. The launching of SACWA, I am told, is scheduled to take place sometimes in January or February 2013, and that will also serve as a further platform for members other outside of DERCO to come in and give views and input and to a certain extent influence the foreign policy. ARF, what economic benefits and bilateral trade? I'll leave that to Ambassador Lali, and if necessary, I'll give him some input on that one. With regard to the employment outside of Dirk, how far we are, I'll ask Nicolette to deal with it, unless she wants me to deal with it, but I'll let me give her an opportunity. Absence of security and DRP in our department. Chairperson, it is true that the Auditor General reported that we don't have a disaster recovery plan. We had already engaged with CETA about 4 months ago to develop a disaster recovery plan for us. Now, my the report that I got from the acting CIO and from the CEO of CETA was that, in fact, they are at a very advanced stage. They have progressed with regard to the development of the plan. However, should a natural disaster or other disaster hit our building in Johannesburg, will we be at risk with regard to the information we have on the systems? The answer to that is we do back up our information on a daily basis, and on a weekly basis we back up all the information that is existing on our system. Once a week we back up all the information, and on a daily basis we back up the information from the last time we back up. So on a Friday we do a full backup, then on a Saturday we back up from the time we back up Friday to Saturday, and Sunday we do the same. And we store this information on site. We have it at the waterproof guest house, Tony Matakini guest house. We keep those things here. So the answer is that indeed, if there is a catastrophe or disaster, we do have information. Of course, the information would probably be 24 hours old. We may not be in a position to, or we may have lost information over the last 24 hours, depending on when the disaster is, because the backups take place at a specific time. But indeed, we would have had information up to the 24 hours prior, stored at our waterproof guest house. But the disaster recovery plan is a lot more than just backup. It talks about replacement of computer equipment, it talks about replacement of taking your business out of that site and being able to operate elsewhere. And that is the plan that the CETA is going to assist us with. It requires the involvement and engagement of a lot of senior officials in the department. For example, we have to determine, should there be a disaster at Johannesburg, we will have to work with the private party who manages our building. Where will we then relocate the department to continue the business? Where will we get the computer equipment from? Where will we get transport from? So those are the things that go into a disaster recovery plan, or a business continuity plan, as we call it, that is separate from a backup of the information, electronic information. But I would like to assure you that the electronic information is being backed up to store as well. AGOA, I will ask Dr. Morton to deal with that. Delay Lama, I've given it to Ian already. Consultants. South Africa will deal with that. ANC Centenary and Mangaung. No, I didn't want to skip over that. What happens is that at the ANC Centenary and Mangaung in January of this year, a number of heads of state and heads of government were invited. Now, in terms of international protocol, the Vienna Convention and the Geneva Conventions, when a head of state or head of government visits a country, there are certain protocols, requirements that the country must provide. Whether it's a private visit or a state, of course, if it's a state and official visit, it's a lot more, there'll be a 21-day unit and all of that stuff. But when it's on a private or a working visit, there are certain protocols, security,
certain accommodation requirements that we have to provide. Our department provided that for the visiting head to stay in Accra. We did not make a contribution to the celebration. We had nothing to do with that. We took care, our department simply took care of those protocol requirements that were necessary in terms of international practice for the visiting head to stay in Accra government who were invited to that. So, Chairperson, with your permission, I will just go down the line. Ian will start and answer some of the questions. Ambassador Lali, that is needed. Miss Africa, and then, have I missed something again? Oh, Nicolette, I'm sorry, Nicolette. Shaba, Miss Gazida, Miss Africa, and then Dr. Moulton.
Maybe they can start. I will assist you in having the correct wording for my cartoon.
Let me first turn to the performance information question. One of the problems that we face with in Durco, if you look at the framework of performance information that was issued by National Treasury, it's mostly focused, if you look at on quantitative type of indicators and so on. It's very difficult for Durco in the past to wrote things like that. For example, if you look on most of the audit findings, they were on the multilateral side. It's very difficult to measure things on the multilateral side, you know, trade offs and things like that. And so we struggled with writing indicators for the multilateral targets and so on. I think we've come around to that. The system that's been introduced that comes from the Canadians and the World Bank. They work very closely, the two, on the system. I think we've come around to that, finding solutions to some of these challenges that we have with the Auditor General on this, and also with National Treasury. If you look at our APP for 12-13 and now for 13-14, it would look very different from the past. I think I would dare to say that, in fact, we've actually, if you look at across the world, which we did that different, how they measure these things, we're probably the only country in the world that goes in such detail in terms of our foreign relations that we publish in such great detail. There's no other country in the world, even the Canadians, that is the, that we put it, the originator of the system. In many, the Australians have it, there are many other countries, but not in such detail, specifically for foreign policy. Because it is a sensitive area, it's also an area that you probably don't want to go into too great detail on certain issues. But I think we've managed that. We sent somebody to Canada to look at the system there and to see how we can improve our own system, which we did. Then we now provided training, literally, to all the heads of mission on the APP, how to draft with mission APPs. We've trained all the number twos in the missions. We've trained everybody at head office at the branches on the APPs and what is required. And we now even gone so far as training the deputy directors in Berkeley. So I think we've really embedded it in the culture of Durco, the new APP system, and I think this is hopefully the last time that you will see such findings on performance information on that. Let me just to the question of the Dalai Lama. South Africa's policy has always been very clear on the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama is two in one, if I can put it this way. It's a religious figure, but also it sees itself as head of the Tibetan you know, a government in exile. So it carries a dual purpose. It's a, what is the king priest, if I can, a type of figure. It's, and you cannot really separate the two. There's no country in the world that recognizes independent Tibet. And South Africa fully subscribes to that position. Secondly, is if you talk to the Tibetans, what now is Tibet is not what they claim for themselves. In fact, it's a third of China, the original. That's what they want, the original Tibet, and there's no way the Chinese will adhere to that. Apart from that, he is a world religious figure. I think we do realize that, and so on. But we don't subscribe to the fact that he is a head of, you know, he claims a head of a government in exile. I mean, it's somebody like somebody in South Africa saying, I'm from a province by head of the government in exile. So there's an international law position on the Dalai Lama, but at the same time, I mean, the challenge for us is also that, I mean, he has relations for Archbishop Tutu, former Archbishop Tutu, and things like that. So is the court case that is on at the moment on this. But I think from an international perspective, we look very carefully at that. We consulted even lawyers outside that on this question of the Dalai Lama, and everybody was in agreement with us that from an international law perspective, I think that there cannot be defaulted on our position on the Dalai Lama. Yes, you know, if you see, he goes around the world, he's got a lot of support base, he's got a lot of Hollywood behind him, and so on, and a lot of religious figures. And, you know, he came here in the past, I remember 96, I personally met him at the airport in 96, and he's a really nice man. I don't want to say anything about him, but there is the international law position on the Dalai Lama. Just on Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is very interesting. If you look at the relationship between Taiwan and China, has changed dramatically. There's now a free trade agreement between Taiwan and China. There are strong party-to-party relations between the Communist Party in China and the Kuomintang on Taiwan. Thirdly, you've got now direct flights. It's one of the biggest growing tourists from mainland China to Taiwan. I think the last figure I saw was nearly 2 million per annum. I don't think there's a province in China where a party secretary of the province has not visited Taiwan. So it's a totally new relationship between Taiwan and China, which we must take cognizance of. But if you look at Taiwan today, the economy of Taiwan is totally integrated into the Chinese economy. Taiwan is one of the largest investors in the mainland. Secondly, if you look at it, Taiwan doesn't manufacture that much anymore. But it is a manufacturer of high-tech stuff like computer chips, software, and things like that. If you look at this iPad, about 60% of that comes from Taiwan, from companies of Taiwan. It's a very interesting article that you can read in one of the newspapers, how Taiwan, although it's assembled by Foxconn in China, most of the parts here either come from Japan, Korea, or Taiwan. In this. But intellectual property rights lies in the area of America. That's another debate. So what you find here, you'll find that Taiwan is a member of WTO. They actually sit on the WTO as Taiwan in Minamatsu, as a regional territory. It's been permitted by China. In fact, China hasn't got problems. You know, the more you deal with Taiwan, the more actually support China and ask for counsel. So there's no restriction. It's on the political side where the sensitivities lie, and that will apply fully to the One China principle. But being that, I mean, we do, if you look at our trade exports, Taiwan is one of the fastest growing, especially our value-added exports to Taiwan, especially in the automotive sector. One of the big growing items to Taiwan is BMW. In fact, they want more imports from BMW than what we can supply at this stage. So, colleagues, I hope this, and honorable members, I hope this really helps on performance information. I don't think there's anything else you want to do. Maybe you must go. I've been out of bricks for a year now.
Thank you very much. I will start with the question around provinces, because I think that is the one question that almost everybody has referred to. There is a body, the ICTR.
Let me see if I
ask.
Consultative Forum of
International Relations. Thank you. We have this body, and it meets twice a year. And people who compose this body are other government parties, provinces, local governments, and it's coordinated by the court. We also have got an approved paper on the conduct of international relations. But even with these two instruments in place, it is extremely difficult for DIRCO to one, monitor, or two, advise provinces and local governments on what they must do or where they will show interest. We try to do it. We do have the teeth, although blunt, to do it, but they remind us that they are not peers of government, but peers of government. In cases where there is a feeling that the national department does not take care of their needs sufficiently, they have the right to actually go out there and push their agenda. which I must say in the main is usually under the umbrella of our foreign policy. But where they feel that they are not receiving as much attention as they want, they do reserve the right and the exercises to go out there and do things on their own. The best we can do is to persuade them, especially in the ICT avenue, we meet twice a year, the last meeting was last Monday, is for them to at least inform us. Because what you usually find is very difficult is a delegation arriving at a foreign mission, unexpected, and having used consultants that they paid exorbitant amounts to, and those consultants then use our people at missions, because our missions are well staffed. So the province or local government pays consultants X so many millions to arrange a mission to a country, and the consultants make our officials at mission sweat, basically, and they run away with the money. But then that is all due respect is for those entities. So to answer that question quickly, is we try to be guidance, and we do indicate, especially high traffic areas where you have national departments, provinces, local governments going, and cases in point are usually Cuba, Brazil, and India, where actually those countries say, oh, please, stop, enough. But you also have very enthusiastic and active foreign missions in South Africa, which go to provinces and encourage bilateral interaction between specific provinces in their countries and our own country where they see synergies. And of course, it is very flattering attention. And in some instances, it actually does build results. On the diplomatic training program, which is currently underway in Pretoria at the moment, we've had two provinces coming to present. That was last week, the Free State and the Eastern Cape. And in their presentation, they actually angled their presentation to speak to what the mission, the heads of mission and the foreign training could do for those provinces. The Eastern Cape gave a comprehensive presentation on the economic, the IGZ, which they are now renaming the ESZ, the SEZ. They went into great detail about what's happening in Guha. And having been in the department for quite a while, and having visited Guha from when it was an idea, when it was scrabble and felt, and when we were assisting the Guha management in their international roadshow, to seeing presented on the screen how Guha has grown, the billions of investment that they have in the ground and the ones in the pipeline, we are quite proud of the role that we've played in this department. They also went into great detail about the cooperation they are looking for in terms of getting the Umthombo refinery online. And that also speaks to where South Africa is going to be sourcing this oil, because I'm sure the members know the differences between oil and what you do with heavy oil and street oil. And we have almost every second country on the continent discovering that they are sitting on a lake of oil and a lake of gas. So our dependence on oil from the Middle East and Iran is going to go down, because the Gulf of Guinea and the continent is just sitting on oil. So we do foresee that we will assist the Eastern Cape in respect of Guha. They also gave a very long presentation detailed on what's happening with Islanda. That also looks like it really is ticking along very nicely. So from that point of view, we definitely do see synergies. And they did indicate that they will identify specific countries, specific regions, with specific projects, and see where they want to go. The Free State did the same. They actually had a very well-structured presentation, which started with all the bilateral agreements and MOUs that they signed as a province over the years. They indicated the dead papers. They indicated the ones that are ticking along. They also indicated the new ones. And on the day they arrived, the day before, they had actually just signed an MOU with a company in the UAE where they've gone into an agreement on cut flowers that will be grown in the Free State and exported to that market. So in terms of how the provinces are really going out there and clawing out space for themselves and their economic activity, they really do work. And where they work together with us is absolutely fantastic. Where they don't, it's unfortunate, but it's our job to help anyway. So when provinces arrive in foreign countries and the South African embassy. The embassy is obliged to assist, and in most cases they do assist. But I can also add on a sweet note for us is that when provinces are very enthusiastic and determined to go to countries, the budgets of the departments, which are always being cut, as Mr. Moti always tell us, do more with less, are extended. Because when they budgeted for a mission and they budgeted for a program, they pay their own, which is very light on our budget and which we really appreciate. And then just to tack on to that one, the issue around the bilateral agreement, so many, and we follow up. Yes, indeed, there was a time when every structured bilateral interaction or state visit had to be accompanied by the signing of some or other agreement. But the fact of the matter is we cannot give expression to all of them. We cannot be all over the place. So in instances where those agreements speak to our priorities, indeed we work and they do assist. But also, because of our relative youth, we must admit that there are some agreements, especially the old ones, where we were taken advantage of. For example, if you go into aviation and you look at the fifth freedom right that allow foreign carriers to land at OR Tambo in Cape Town and then pick up passengers to go to Latin America, you shouldn't have accepted that. And the ones that have expired, you've allowed to expire because it's not good for us. You also find in instances with some countries of various importance where they will sign just a letter, we used to call it a cultural agreement, where we recognize this and we use flowery language, and they slip in there that you undertake to look after the interests of this country's nationals in your country. And when you look at it, especially in respect of China and Taiwan before, you find that in the Free State, as they say, there are huge Taiwanese communities. And they have an agreement that says they will look after their interests and protect them. And do we have a huge contingent of South Africans in Taiwan? No, we don't. So countries use them for different reasons. So what is done now, especially with the focus on economic diplomacy, is we are really narrowing our focus. And those ones that were fantastic. And if I may also just use this one to tag on to how this relates to what we give in respect of the arts. South Africa has to take a decision, and it's a decision that will be taken by our political principles, I think, not by officials, of how we want to play our position of influence in the world. Other countries are unequivocal. As the chair said, if USAID gives you money for X, they are very clear about what they will get back in return, because in terms of who is going to be consulting, who will carry out the work, where you'll procure, they are very clear to the Americans. To date, we have not been as ruthless, but lately we have gotten a call. I have to say to the members that we do, where possible, especially projects that are happening on the continent, we do insist. For example, with the assistance that we are giving now to Lesotho, and with assistance that we've given to other parts of the continent under our port humanitarian assistance, we insist where possible that South African projects be used. Somebody is looking for maize and they are sitting in Central Africa or in West Africa or even in North Africa, as in Mauritania, and they say, oh, it's cheaper for us to source maize somewhere in Europe, or we say, no, you can't do that. Because we cannot, at the expense of South African and African farmers, go and purchase subsidized products from Europe. So we are growing our teeth and we are starting to flex our muscles. And I cannot draw direct parallels, but I also cannot fail to make the connection between the assistance that was given to the DRC and the final sign-off of the Grand Zinga project. I cannot draw a direct parallel, but I also cannot ignore the possible connection. So we do have ways of leveraging how we assist on the left to help with what we are looking for on the right. But to say that we've become like the US and other recognized donor countries, we are not. I have to say. And also our foreign policy, we still want to come from a place of ubuntu. where when you help your neighbor, as we did with Malawi during that crisis, you don't do that with an end or a return always. And sometimes the returns we get will not be short term, but long term. And they might come back in other ways that are not as obvious or that you can monetize. The cost of Minister Dlamini Zuma's lobbying, I think that I will hand over to Mr. Mudli, but I do want to indicate that the lobbying campaign was not anticipated to take as long as it did, because we thought that we would do this and get it done in January. And then in January, we had the impact. And when we had the impact, we were part of the letter, the political solution, which led to the appointment of the ad hoc committee of eight, which was traveling to Benin. I think our president went there 3 times to try and find a solution before realizing that I'm trying to find a diplomatic term for this. We were being played, you know, keep South Africa talking. So we continued with that, we kept good things, but then we started following the legal processes of submitting our candidates. Name, time, in order for it to be in place, and we went into lobbying and going into really making the candidate a FedEx candidate. And indeed, South Africa has spent money because we have traveled to most capitals of this continent, because we realized that our message had not been understood, and those people who were working against our candidature, wherever in the world they may be, were sending signals that could only take South African heavyweights to go and explain to those heads of state who were going to vote that since 1963, indeed, there had never been a candidate from the South. And if they said something about this infamous gentleman's agreement, Zambia and Namibia, small countries, had tried and had been surpassed. And the region, not just South Africa, had now decided it was our turn. And that it really, really, for a continent of the size that speaks to unity, to have an unfair agreement that it will almost always be French-speaking countries coming from a particular part of the continent that would be, was simply untenable. And another fact of the matter is we are one of 5 countries that carry the bulk of the AU's budget. So why would we be good enough when it comes to putting in millions to keep the AU afloat, but then be considered too big and too scary to run the country? And if I may use that to segue into Resolution 1973, one of the discoveries that was made by South Africa and Southern Africa as the lobbying process was underway was that the reason the AU's roadmap on how to resolve Libya could not be implemented was because the budget of the AU, the operational budget of the AU, is largely from Europe. And because Europe had already taken a decision on NATO, they stopped the Peace and Security Commissioner, Commissioner Lamamra, from going to Libya and assisting with rolling out our roadmap, which had to do with finding a solution, but not regime change, certainly not the killing of former President Gaddafi. So the relations we have as a continent with those people who have more resources than us, sadly have an impact on the resolution we can find to problems. But South Africa tries its best to really advance a foreign policy where Africa takes charge of its destiny. Delays in art, honorable members, the delays are not intentional, but they are part of following due process, because spending government money is as difficult as not spending it, because we have to follow supply chain rules. And the people who work on ARPS assessments are not dedicated officials who only work on ARPS. They are officials at finance in our department and at the treasury who work on other issues. So while we prepare the paperwork, we perform due diligence, we assist with the appointment of service providers. It takes time. And where there's no emergency, we can live with it. But where there are emergencies, it's difficult. For example, in the case of Lesotho, if we decide to outsource that project to the World Food Programme of the UN, they have a system where from appointment to delivery on the ground, they can take about a week. But with our processes, we cannot do it in under 2 weeks. Especially the issue around the letters of concurrence between our minister and the minister of finance. So that's why we said it's structural, and we trust that until SASPA is enacted, we will find ways of getting around in order to be nimble and respond, especially to humanitarian crises. Oh, and back to Resolution 1973, I'm sure Dr. Morrison will speak to it. South Africa is not the only African country which voted for 1973, which is a fact that a lot of people overlook. There are three African countries which sit on the Security Council. And on this one, we unanimously, all 15 said yes, including Nigeria and Gabon. So why every time it comes up, it becomes a South African baby is a mystery. Swaziland, I couldn't really speak to Swaziland except to say that this is not something that has served to my recollection on us, and to remind that conditions or not, Swaziland is a sovereign state, and they reserve the right to ask for and accept help where it best serves them. And as with most countries which for one reason or another do not make headway with Country X, there's almost always a countrywide which will come in and support. There are many friends and enough says, if you look at the number of countries to discover that they are sitting on oil and gas, there are very many people on this continent who are sitting on resources that they can share with countries that need assistance. And the issue about one country, one mission and focus, this has been a challenge on the budget, I must say, because we have noted that partner departments, notably the DTI and Home Affairs, are withdrawing warm bodies from mission. So where one would have officials from the DTI to do trade, Home Affairs to do immigration and consular, we find that it is DILCO officials who have to do this work, which is one of the reasons we have this focus on economic diplomacy. Because if the DTI is not there, or they tell you up front that you are not on our radar, the work still needs to be done. So we do it all the same. And the focus on Asia is not a problem for us, because Asia is where it's at right now, and Africa is the next wing. So for both of us to be looking primarily at Asia and Africa is good for South Africa. And how does the public influence foreign policy? Well, we do have roundtables with civil society. We do engage with NGOs, and we do include members of civil society in election observer missions that we take, so that the South African contingent is made up of officials, of parliamentarians, and members of civil society. But we find that the premier civil society organ, which is ECOSOC, is rather dysfunctional. There are three active people in it. And it's not possible for us to say, when we've engaged with the three persons on ECOSOC, we've engaged with civil society. And we believe that it is for civil society to organize themselves in order to engage with us. But we do reach out. But the one arm of civil society that's engaged with more than any other is academia. And that one came to the end. And on the monitoring of foreign missions, Mr. Mood has always indicated and Mr. Basson has indicated the reporting the APT, the quarterly report. And there is a requirement on missions to submit to the staff, at least to their business unit, once a month, a comprehensive report on what the mission has done. And what we also do as a matter of practice is when a head of mission has had a high-level contact in that country, within a 72-hour period, they are required to write a report and inform the business unit. And in most instances, if it is a call to action, they do have an obligation to write a report and be in liaison with head office, because head office needs to know. So we do have a way of monitoring mission, and there are both carrots and sticks for those that comply. And if you're not able to get more information. And to the Honourable Sinclair, the absence of references to regional integration. Regional integration is one of our priorities, and especially SADC, it is. However, if one looks at what has happened in the world, the enthusiasm for regional integration, especially leading to monetary union, has been lower on account of what happened in the Eurozone. And here, we already discussed FTAs and PTAs as SAFO, not as SAFO. Just this past week, I read that our finance ministers have finally agreed on some way forward in terms of how we are going to handle financial instruments. And we do have an FTA with Insider, which was launched in August 2008. And last year in June, the grand one was launched, which was in the presentation covering the three regions. SADC, the East African Community, and the third one, and COMESA. So we are serious about it. But the problem is that South Africa is always the big elephant in the room. We are always the big elephant in the room. In good times, our size and our strength is appreciated in SADC. But there are times when it works against us and we are considered to be bullied. So it's also about finding a way of moving forward on very sensitive issues with people who are not the same tribe, with people who are open to pressure that South Africa can withstand, as in the case of the Economic Partnership Agreement of the EU. But politically, economically, socially, we are still very much committed to regional integration, and we work on it on all fronts. And one of the areas where it's really going to come into its own is in how the Presidential Infrastructure Championing Initiative is going to roll out, because it is about opening up this corridor which joins the various regions. So it's an economic imperative. We cannot get away from it. But the speed with which we proceed has to be based on the level at which we can build coalitions and move everyone along at the same time, and take into account both their interests and their fears. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable board members. In terms of the vacancy rate, I think Mr. Moodley has already mentioned the difficulty that we have. I think the department took a decision that we would like to give our staff the opportunity to progress. Therefore, we do fall a number of our vacancies from within the department, which creates another vacuum. We also have quite a high natural attrition. We've looked at the past 3 years. We do lose about 150 people per year through death, through retirement. At the moment, we do have a lot of retirement of people who are now getting to that age of retiring. So it pushes up our vacancy rate through that as well. But we do have a strategy in place. We are trying to fill the vacancies as soon as they become vacant. It is a challenge. We understand that, and we are addressing it as best as possible. With regard to our disability and gender, disability, I remember that the figures that were given were at 31 March 2012. We have progressed in the meantime. We are now at 1.9%, so we are very close to the 2%, and we still hope to get there before the end of this financial year. With gender, we are now at 37%. Within the department, there are concerted efforts to appoint women at SMS level. Where we have control over it, we do look at that management. One thing to keep in mind is that we also have political appointees that become our heads of mission, and they also form part of the statistics where the department does not have control over. So it also, we need to take that into consideration. With regard to the question on why we use African and not black, we report in terms of the economically active population to the Department of Labor, and they categorize it as such, where African differentiate between black, colored and Indian, while black is a generic term that includes all three. We have to differentiate between the different groups. Are what remunerated work outside of public service? This is a difficult one to manage or to monitor for us. What the public service does allow its officials to work outside of government with approval from the Director General. Now, we on an annual basis send out a reminder to our officials. Our Director General in our management meetings emphasizes this. The only thing that we can do now is to really start taking disciplinary action against those officials who are picked up that they are actually performing these duties outside of government without getting the necessary approval. So we are aware that the Auditor General obviously picks it up because they put my name through Cipro and then they find out that I am doing something outside of government. So we are really trying to make managers aware that this should not happen. That's at this stage what we can do about that. But there are others that really follow the rules, they do apply, and the Director General will then decide whether this is a conflict of interest. If it's a conflict of interest, we will turn it down also. So it is something that we insist in the department, but difficult to manage if people don't tell us that they are going to engage in employment outside of the public service.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members. I'm going to deal with supply chain issues, compliance with regard to supply issues at missions. Currently, the department has approved financial delegation of authority that regulates the procurement process within the department. For example, our missions are allowed to approve procurement up to $26,000. Anything above that comes to come up to approval within our bid committee. So that's the process. And all procurement for missions that are done in South Africa obviously follow South African principles. So as a department, we have that delegation of authority that guides missions in terms of all procurement process. Furthermore, we also do provide training within the training institutes within the department for all officers that are posted abroad, the heads of missions, the corporate service managers, the attachers. We do provide training to all of them with regard to supply chain issues. And also, we also raise these issues during our, every year we have a mid-term review process where we review our budget. So we do those trainings and also update missions with regard to any compliance issues that might have been updated from this natural level. And from time to time, we also communicate with our missions through circulars. And this year we had regional head of missions. Our financial manager also discussed these issues with head of missions in order to ensure that missions comply. But maybe just to indicate that one of the issues that auditors has raised in the last audit report was the issue of protection, because in actual fact, missions don't necessarily comply to South African supply chain process because we don't necessarily use, they don't have South African companies abroad. But where they procure in South Africa will also follow South African process. So we do those trainings give them updates in terms of all supply chain issues. One of the issues that we also did is to develop a checklist, because there are specific issues within supply chain, your quotation, your database, your thresholds. So we develop a checklist that we monitor on all procurement of goods and services. So if there's a request that is presented, we look at all those issues to say, are we complying as an organization? And in our organization, large part of our procurement is in ICT, which we follow CETA Act, and also traveling, which we currently use a travel agent, and we have a card that we pay. So suppliers who don't necessarily
not comply with the 30-day period because we use for traveling with each other card, and for ICT we use the Tika app and make sure that we pay with them. We have contracts, most of the ICT procurement we have contracts that we pay on monthly basis. And with regard to the 30-day compliance, as a department we are trying by all means to comply with the 30-day. Yes, there are still gaps. And more often it's because of non-compliance where you find that the services that were rendered without following the process. So for us to regularize, it means then when you receive invoices, units must present to the bid committee for digital approval because we must be the only person that can regularize those payments. But we've been submitting those compliance certificates to National Treasury. We submitted up to end of September. And one of the problems is the issue of the transversal system, because as government is in transversal system, some of the things we don't have necessary controls in terms of the slowness of the system, but it challenges that our CFO discussed with the speaker to make sure that at least we have facilities that enable us to comply with this issue. And then with regard to aging, National Treasury has a template that all the government departments need to complete with regard to all the findings that have been raised, and we are required to submit the progress report on a monthly basis. We have developed that plan, and the plan was basically the task team that the accounting officer has appointed, which consists of managers within the branches in the department. We have developed a plan with regard to those issues that we have raised in the last financial year, and we have presented the plan during our strategic plan, which was in September. And then early November, we had a midterm review, so departmental midterm review, where we presented the progress in terms of those issues that we raised, and we submit the progress to National Treasury on a monthly basis and also to the AG. I think those are all the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. On the issue of security, the honourable member is obviously correct that for us one of the biggest issues, both during a construction project and in the normal operation of our missions, is how do we manage security. When we do any construction project, we have a multidisciplinary team that assists us in dealing with the project, and that consists of a set of consultants and then a government team. In this government team, we will have the Department of International Relations, our security team, then the Department of Public Works that assists us as a technical advisor, and then our colleagues in the SSI. So both the SSI domestic branch and security branch will be involved in the development of how do we plan a project, how do we design a project, and how then do we do the actual implementation. When we do the implementation and the construction of any project, obviously we will have this team visit. We also have, in our regions, we have what is called regional security officers. So they will form an integral part of this construction team to assist us to try and deal with our security issues as best as possible. Once we then have a construction project completed, then obviously your security continues to be a big issue for the mission. So we also again have our colleagues at SSA that visit our missions, and they visit in excess of 40 missions per annum. They then prepare formal security reports where they deal with all aspects from their physical security to the information security. That then comes to the department, and we have a task team to try and then deal with those security reports. At this point, the department has identified again the need for us to just relook security at our missions and see how can we assist them better in their security. We have identified an amount of money that we can make available in this financial year, and we are presently busy reviewing all of the SSI reports. We have reviewed at this point about 96 reports in the past two financial years to see and to identify what are the additional security measures that we can possibly take. When we look at the issue of appointment of consultants, I just want to contextualize specifically the Abuja one a little bit to say what we have done in Abuja was to construct a chancery and an official residence. The $21 million that was spent on four consultants over a period of 5 years. again, when we appoint a set of consultants as part of that disciplinary, multidisciplinary team, we will appoint a South African architect, engineer, and quantity surveyor. They will then assist the department and our government partners from the point where we do the feasibility study, through the planning of the project, the detailed design of the project, the appointment of the local contractor, and supervising the contractor to the end of the project. So 20 million then really represents the entire consultancy services for the entire period of 5 years. In our procurement of these type of consultants, we follow the South African normal procurement process, so we go out on tender. I am sure that that we have all seen the Department of Public Works do publish the gazetted rights for all of these professionals, architects, engineers, quantity surveyors. So we then follow the same process as our colleagues in public works. We get these people to tender for us the gazetted rights or a reduction on the gazetted rights. So that is how we will appoint them to try and get the best service. You will also see from some of the other consultants that obviously when we appoint a consultant, there will be a fixed fee for the design of the project and the planning. But when you get to the construction, they charge a percentage of the value of the project. So, and that, like I say, is a gazetted one. And we try and see if we can find a reduction on that as we go through a project. I trust that I have dealt with the construction issue.
Yeah, I'm just worried because they follow the same process as public works. Next year they will come with a qualified one, following the same process as public works.
Thank you, Mr. Moodley. Honourable Chairperson, Honourable Members. I'll start with the Security Council and just add what has already been said by my colleagues in terms of 1973 and the vote on Libya. The focus of 1973 was the protection of civilians against the threat of mass atrocities. Unfortunately, the mandate, the Chapter 7 mandate of that resolution was then overstepped and abused. Under the guise of a shift of focus on the agenda to regime change, in the pretext of responsibility to protect. So clearly the focus of the agenda and of the resolution originally and South Africa's vote in that context was then overtaken by developments with the abuse of the mandate that was given in terms of that resolution. In terms of the Security Council and the AU Peace and Security Council and the benefits for Africa and for South Africa, there is a very strong congruence between South Africa's foreign policy priorities and the items that are on the agenda of the Security Council. And that is why it's so important to be at the table and to be making the decisions on these issues, to have the voice of Africa heard and to ensure that the views of South Africa inform the resolutions that are being negotiated in the Security Council. The fact that we took this further, in our first non-permanent term on the Security Council, we continually stressed the need to work with regional institutions and particularly, from our perspective, the African Union. And we were able, when we chaired the Security Council in January of this year, we were excuse me, able to formalize that and to take that further with the adoption of Resolution 2033 to effectively institutionalize that partnership and that level of cooperation. With regard to AFCON, not to be confused with the forthcoming AFCON, the request for details, we have been selected to host the secretariat for AFCON. What will be required now is to negotiate a host country agreement and set up the secretariat with office space in South Africa. And there was a meeting a couple of days ago in Addis to begin to look at the issue of member country assessed annual contributions and what the financial implications would be, but I have not unfortunately seen the outcome of that meeting yet. But first and foremost, there will be a need to negotiate this host country agreement and establish the secretariat formally with office space and all of the legal and diplomatic privileges and immunities that go with setting up such an international office. In terms of GOA, it's slightly out of my area, but what I can say is when we had Secretary Clinton recently in South Africa at her last visit, there was an agreement to push for renewal for South Africa in terms of AGOA. Obviously, this is an issue that will be dealt with now by the new Obama administration and the new Congress in the U.S. But clearly, it's an important issue in terms of market access issue, not only for South Africa, but for developing countries. There are aspects of AGOA, of course, where it's clear that the concessions that are given are also in the interest of the U.S. in terms of what they are looking for in their own markets. But market access and the provisions of AGOA are clearly very important in moving forward, and the renewal is very important in that regard. I think those are the questions you asked me to answer. Thank you.
Very quickly on BRICS and just to highlight, there was a question around what are the advantages for South Africa not signing on BRICS. The department has been giving some sort of information to the public and so forth with regard to our participation in BRICS, and that's the roadshow, the provincial roadshow, say the provincial, what a BRICS bus that's going to go through the 9 provinces, really giving information to the South African populace on what are the advantage of South African member of BRICS, why should we be here? Now, just to give some of the information here as well, is that if you just look at, first of all, the BRICS countries themselves represents 1/3 of the world's population, just market size. Then they represent, I think, 18% of the, almost 20% now, of the world's GDP, the world's gross domestic product. We saw in the presentation earlier the ranking of the economies of those China, Brazil, India, and so forth. Now, the position that South Africa has, and the Honourable Member rightfully said, is that we are strategically placed to take advantage of the opportunities that the BRICS countries present. All of the BRICS countries represent developing economies that's going to change the focus of economic power in the coming years. The only country that is outside of the South grouping is probably Russia. Now, on the continent, on African continent itself, there is, as we all know, a sort of a high demand for the resources and so forth. At this moment in time, yes, there is a huge amount of natural resources that is flowing out of the African continent, going towards India and especially China. But there is a very strong desire to basically provide manufacture and beneficiation goods out of the African. When that happens, and it's going, and probably the indications are that it's going to happen soon, is what would South Africa's position, what would South Africa's contribution be on that, in that whole interaction with the rest of the world? Now, we already know that China and India has very serious foreign policy intentions on their own, and that is to go directly to the countries on the continent, especially those countries with a high, very rich in mineral resources and so forth, and to try and get the best possible advantage for those countries. Now, with the agreement, with the arrangement, it's South Africa is well positioned to be a part of that strategy, to manage and to ensure that the African interest, the entire African interest, is considered in this scramble, as you can say, or this rush for the natural resource on the African continent. And also to come to a situation where there's value added to the natural resource on the African continent. Now, we do know that the Chinese authorities, this matter was raised between our president and the President Xi at some point, that in fact the balance of trade is very much in favor of the Chinese, and also the Chinese imports from Africa is always wrong. So there was a huge discussion around
the fact that this has to change. And the Chinese authorities have made the offer to the South Africans, and of course, by extension, the continent as well, that indeed they are willing to assist us in regularizing the balance of trade and also in the value added to the natural resources. So that's the first one. Then the second thing is that, in terms of the BRICS Development Bank, what will be the main focus of the BRICS Development Bank? One of the main things of the BRICS Development Bank will be is to harness the surplus resources that countries like China, India, and Brazil have. I think the figures tell you that at the moment China has foreign reserves of almost $1 trillion, US dollars, lying there, scheduled for profitable investment. Now, the question about why can't it be channeled through the carbon credit with institutions is that the governance mechanism in the carbon credit with institutions do not make it easy for those monies to be channeled into projects, development projects in the LDCs and the developing countries. Very difficult the governance mechanism. So what would happen is that the BRICS-led bank, the development bank, will enable these surplus funds to be channeled through those projects with a lesser guaranteed fund, so that infrastructure development programs can take place. I mean, our president is already the champion of the infrastructure development project on the continent. The last figure sampled was that we require about $220 billion to deal with the infrastructure development projects on the continent. So the BRICS-led development bank would be well positioned to deal with that. Where would South Africa play a role? How would South Africa take advantage of that? Clearly, we would like to host the bank so we can influence the way the bank is governed, the way the bank is managed. We would like to be the gateway from here. It would create more employment in the country. It would provide more opportunities for South Africa. It would produce a whole lot of further advantages for the country. That's just on the BRICS-led development bank. Then we have the other objectives of alleviating poverty, of rural development. All of these things is strongly focused in the BRICS makeup. Now, should South Africa not be part of that, we would not be able to influence that, and we would not be able to take advantage of it. I must say that the information that is coming to us is that it is also a very fragile, very volatile situation, because at the moment South Africa represents or is the biggest economy on the African continent. But that will change if we do not have our strategies in place and so forth in the next couple of years. And there could be a situation where at some point later, for the year 2050 or 2030, if we are not clear on our strategy and our focus with regard to BRICS itself, that in fact there may be other members on the continent who will take advantage of the opportunities that we have. So there's huge opportunities, advantages for us. One of the first one is to balance the imbalance of our. With regard to Minister Zuma's lobbying, I think members would recall that it was the first round and the second. Now, the first round would take place last year. We had utilized about 6 million rands to do the entire lobbying. But then we shifted focus in the second round. In the second round, although the candidate was a static candidate, in the second round, the emphasis of Minister Dlamini Zuma being a static candidate was given a lot of reinforcement. So what had happened was that in the lobbying, high-level officials from the SADC countries was then brought on board to go and do the lobbying of with the various different countries on the continent. So of course that cost a little more money. We had budgeted a further 6 million rand in the current financial year to deal with that for the second round. So let's separate that. There was the first round which took place, and ended in no candidates being recognized situation. Then it moved to the second round where SADC endorsed our candidate as a SADC candidate, and then we brought SADC on board. I don't know the full extent of the expenditure yet, it's still working through that, but the budget was provided for that. With regard to ARS emergencies, it is a matter that I discussed with the DG just before he departed yesterday. He says that this is something that is concerning to us.
Sure, that should be your last one.
Okay. I will deal with it. So essentially what we are looking at is when you look at the ARF Act, and we will engage with National Treasury to basically talk to the emergencies that Ambassador Lala is talking about, where it takes us 2 or 3 months to deal with the humanitarian situation. As Ambassador Lala is quite correct, as the
our stance right now is going to take processes do impact on us, but we will engage with national pressure to see how best we can shorten the process period so that humanitarian crises are dealt with as humanitarian crises are not. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
We
just
mm-hmm.
wanted to catch up with time. Remember that to attend certain meetings, certain people have lunch hour. yeah, we have meetings during lunch. But thanks very much for the ambassador, the correction and the spelling of John Mahatini. Since we did complete 10 minutes, we have done it. We want our history correctly captured. And honorable members, Mr. Pasod, there's a book that you once mentioned, and I've forgotten the title.
Parting
Shots. Parting Shots. You have to write for me, because I look for it everywhere. I can't get it. You have to write it for me and the author.
I will give you a copy.
A copy? Yeah, just give me it. And do you want to part on our Sinclair?
No, I was just going to ask if the author was Zuma.
not yet, we still have to see that. So I'll get the letter today, Mr. Kuzi, Mr. Paul. And I'll remember, we're having our meeting next Tuesday. Requested Mr. Solomon to come, and on Wednesday, we are supposed to finish the cooperative team by the end of this year. So we've been asked, so Wednesday in the afternoon we'll deal with the team so that on the 4th there's a statement in the house. So that we don't, they are sitting on the 4th, so that we don't meet after the 5th, the 6th and 7th, just to the department. Thanks very much for all the presentation.
Oh, that one. I was wondering where you.
No.
because the guy resigned, the researcher resigned a year ago. So I was standing in. But now since I have a comment, I haven't got.
But
he's
doing good.
Too much work.